Hello and welcome everyone to the Toncast. I am your host, TV's Mr. Neil, and with me today is a very, very special guest, Todd Robert Anderson. How are you doing today?
I'm feeling really good. Thanks for having me on your show. This is very exciting.
Now, I had left a comment on another podcast with a similar name a while ago where I had asked about I don't even remember what it was about, but it was about some government program, and it was like, well, this is ineffective. And I said, well, if it's ineffective, why put money into it? And it was just you had a pretty long answer to everything I had said, and I forgot half of it. And I mean, I did listen. I kind of nodded. I said, okay.
Yeah. Well, if I figure we all listen to about half of the answers of all the stuff that we hear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody really process everything? So I don't hold that against you.
No.
I wish we remembered on some level what the hell it was about, because then maybe I could address it. But I honestly don't remember either. But I have a terrible memory.
Well, I forget half the episodes that are on my other podcast, The Animation Aficionados. It's just...
Do you ever go back and listen to really old ones that you haven't heard in a while?
I do, and I'm like, wow, I don't even remember doing an episode about this. I have to ask sometimes. I'm like, did we do an episode about Sailor Moon?
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
But you guys have a wealth of knowledge about animation, so it stands to reason that it would all blend together what you said out loud and what you just kind of maintained inside your brain,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, I have like some notes about politics, but I'm not a policy by policy guy. There are a lot of things that go on in politics where I just have no opinion because I don't know about it. It's just, but my general perspective is what I said earlier. And I think another thing I addressed was about, rich people and how, you know, it's an assumption that, you know, rich people should contribute more in taxes instead of hoarding their money. But I also kind of think of it as, well, if we're putting money toward things that are ineffective and wasting a lot of government, there's a lot of government spending that just goes to nothing. And my thought on that is, then what's the difference between hoarding and throwing money away, except that the guy hoarding his money is just, it's his money, and the guy throwing away money is throwing away someone else's money.
You mean as far as like what the government is spending other people's money?
Yeah.
Which is just as wasteful perhaps as an individual hoarding money and not
sharing.
Yeah,
if it's money going toward nothing, the simpler would be just let the rich guy have his money sometimes. Not in every case, obviously, because there are government policies that actually do something. But there's
The governments in general are deeply flawed, but yeah. I guess it's in a what's the alternative sort of thing. And as far as hoarding money, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would like to have the option to hoard a gazillion dollars. And I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, you know, if I stepped into the shoes of a multi-billionaire, would I suddenly be like, holy crap, I gotta protect this as much as I can? Would that be my reaction? Or would I be, you know, actually generous, which I'd like to think I would be? Mm-hmm. And should it be an individual choice, I guess, is sort of what we were talking about, versus, you know, society sort of forcing I think we're in particular probably talking about the top 2%, but society, yeah, like really forcing more money out of the wealthy than currently happens, versus, leaving it up to the individual.
Yeah.
And you know, I wish I had like a good answer to that, but I really don't. It's a kind of interesting moral question. But if, I guess if you sort of look at it from the really generalized American, you know, ideal is you, individual freedom, therefore you would have to, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you would sort of have to let the individual decide whether they're rich or poor, what the heck they do with their money, I guess. But, at the same time, you know, we don't, unfortunately, I don't think there's too many gray areas for, you know, general ideals to work. But I mean, I see that argument because idealistically, I would like to leave it up to people. And I don't necessarily, I think things are so sort of out of balance now.
That's a good way to put it.
As far as, just where all the money is and then where all the money isn't. And I would like, more balance. I would like more of a return of the middle class and perhaps, you know, make it larger than it was in its heyday. And maybe we need to redefine it, as it is currently if things are going to remain the way they are. You know, money is power. It really is. And you know, I just think it comes down to, you know, in capitalist American society, really the world at this point, I mean, the massive amount of money is controlled by a very few people, and they are the powers that be, essentially. If perhaps they're not, you know, running the government, they are kind of their own shadow government because they do have so much money and they can change the world with it one way or the other, and they do all the time. So I think it's right now, it's a matter of, you know, a lot of people are complaining about those things. And now I think that those powerful people need to maybe shift their attitude. And if they don't, and I think continue on the path that they're going currently, which is a lot of hoarding. Not everybody. I mean, obviously you got like a guy like Bill Gates who's just turned to philanthropy. I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's like he reached a certain point where he had such a ludicrous amount of money. He realized I don't, you know, really want to make more money. I want to spend it on something that's actually going to make me happy. So I mean, his, you know, life path with his money makes more sense to me than most, but that doesn't happen too often, it seems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you
and,
mean.
And if I felt, you know, personally, I think, you know, as long as there's television and hot food at a reasonable price, then, you know, there's not going to be some kind of, you know, I think this debate will just sort of rage on and there'll be pushes and pulls and, you know, in policies here and there. But I don't see any, I mean, if the Obama administration has proven anything at this point, that there are going to be no drastic changes, as you know, he's in a lot of ways, he got elected on, I'm going to change this right away. And most of those things haven't really changed.
No.
Or there's, you know, now there's policies on the book that'll make these things change maybe in 20 years. We'll see, you know? But I don't know, as far as that, I mean, it's a really good question. I don't have, you know, I mean, and I think when you listen to the political debate as they're presented, you know, on TV, you get so much of, you get so much of these ludicrously extreme, you know, pundit perspectives. Mm-hmm. You know, one guy is saying, yeah, you gotta just, we gotta knock these people down and get all that money back and put it into the system. And then you have other people saying, well, if you do that to them, you know, then that's going to trickle down as if anything ever does, and, you know, destroy the fabric of this nation sort of thing. And I'm like, well, maybe the solution is somewhere in the middle. And I feel like it generally works itself out that way. But who knows if it doesn't? I mean, who knows? Who knows? Maybe there will be a revolution, but I don't think it'll happen in my lifetime anyway.
Yeah. And I think it's good that you say, I don't know, because that's, in internet debates that I've seen, it seems like that answer has such a negative stigma to it that people will resist it, or people will attack people for having kind of a, not exactly a firm case for what their position is. And I think that's another thing I want to talk about is just the nature of debate nowadays where we have such extremism in our views, where we kind of look at different political perspectives. We kind of look at the other side as being monsters, and sometimes it's not always the case. I know sometimes it's like religious extremists, it's like there's no way they can justify half the things they say. But
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but you know, I've heard I don't fall into the Republican camp, but I've heard Republicans say things that I understand, and even if I disagree with them, I'll say, well, you're not a monster. I can see where you're coming from. Same thing with Democrats.
I mean, the people that we hear from in the parties on both sides are representatives of the parties. Mm-hmm. But in order to get reelected, they have to get everybody excited about them.
Yeah.
And they have to start some sort of frenzy in the media so everybody gets worked up and excited. But I think that – I grew up in a town filled with Republicans, and I still every time go back east, I haven't, you know, cut off ties with friendships because they're Republicans or Democrats. Yeah. I guess I generally vote Democratically, or not Democratically, but, you know, for the Democratic Party, just because in general, there's more stuff, you know, in line with my thinking there than in the Republican Party. But that doesn't mean there aren't Republican. There's certain Republican ideals that I agree with. But I just think what gets presented to us all the time is this extreme, like, and that's how debates are handled. I mean, I haven't watched a presidential debate, that I've been cognizant of in my lifetime that felt like an actual debate to me. You know what I mean?
Because actual debate
should allow for some level of concession. I mean, I know when I get in arguments, you know, debates with friends socially, you know, when we're having drinks or whatever, even if it gets heated at some point, if somebody makes a point that I'm like, oh yeah, I hadn't thought of that before, then I might change my opinion from where I'm at. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even something as dumb as like I didn't like that movie and here's why I didn't like it. Well, here's why I liked it. Ah, well, that's an interesting point. Maybe I should look at it again. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that you're right in that the debates that happen on, I mean, certainly online, there's so many egos online when people get in debates, especially, you know, in social media or, you know, in comment sections under a podcast or on, you know, under a video or whatever, everybody's there. There's so much ego. Everybody wants to be their own internet celebrity at some point. You know what I mean?
Correct. Yeah.
And I think that people kind of hang on to their point of view and never kind of open their brain and go, oh, I can actually, that's a good point over there. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I think also that's sort of something that's dictated by the media and the way, you know, politics are now is this, there's just so much of that. I am right. I am right. I am right. That's one side. The other side is I am right. I am right. I am right. And that's it. And there's no actual listening, I guess, is what you would call it.
Right.
Cause yeah. I mean, I think in debates, I think when you watch political debates now, you can see the politician who's quote unquote listening, looking for a place to wreck the guy.
Right.
That is talking. It's not, I'm listening. And you know, it's like an improvisation. You know, you have to yes and. You take somebody makes a suggestion and you say yes, and you build on it. And I think that doesn't really so much happen in debates as much as just talk, 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 point, 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 talk, talk, talk. And there isn't a, well, that's an interesting point, and here's what I would add to this, and here's what I would change. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's all just more of a, no, you're wrong. Here's what I say. No, you're wrong. Here's what I say. And I, you know, that's not debating. That's just yelling at each other.
Right. And I forget who said this, but sometimes it seems like people choose their political stances like they pick football teams, their favorite teams, where they're not really listening to what they're saying. They're more of like just cheering them on, and whatever they say, they'll go along with. The Howard Stern show actually did a really interesting experiment once where they they went out on the street and they talked to people about Obama. But when they talked about Obama, they basically used all of McCain's positions. So they were attributing all of McCain's ideas to Obama, and people were just going along with it. Like, do you agree with Obama's stance on pro-life? And they're like, oh yeah, I totally agree with that. And that's kind of frightening to me that people do that. They're not even thinking about what the policies are. They're just like, well, I picked one side or the other, so I'm just going to go along with everything that person says.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of a scary element of society. I mean, I think so many people wind up being, aligning themselves with a politician or a political party or a, you know, system of beliefs just according to whatever their parents did. I don't think politics is unlike religion in that way. I think a lot of people just hang on to the way they were brought up. It's sort of, cause, you know, I'm a guy who was brought up Catholic, you know, in my parents were, I guess, independents, cause they voted back and forth all the time and, voted for people in the Independent Party, back in the 80s. Which didn't do them any good, obviously. But I mean, I wound up, you know, questioning my religion and questioning, the politics I'd brought, but the politics, my parents' politics were so different than everybody that we were surrounded by. So I guess that helped with me thinking it out on my own. But I guess what I'm just trying to say is that, I don't think a lot of – I think the reason why that happens is in general people don't grow up and start thinking for themselves and start picking whatever fruits off of whatever trees makes more sense to them and developing their own system of political belief that way. They more follow – it's like a faith-based political system, I guess is what you'd say. I just think people don't often divorce themselves from their upbringing.
Right.
Even if their home life was awful, they will hang on to those elements of their childhood. Because it is hard, I think. I mean, I don't judge that at all because I think it's really hard to, lose your religion, so to speak, because, I mean, you have to question yourself and it's hard to dig that deep and it's not easy and it's scary. And when you lose, you know, your core set of beliefs that one of the things that I reflect on all the time about, you know, my former Catholicism is when I was a kid, I mean, And I'd hear about other religions and belief systems, but I took this as the thing, you know, cause this is what my parents did. So this is the thing. This is real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I grew up and started saying, well, if that's real, why do those people think this is real? And why do those people think that is real? And then slowly I started, you know, applying reason to things and going, well, these things don't make reasonable sense. And, you know, the more I questioned, the more I didn't get answers. And so the more I was like, well, I'm not going to church anymore. For one, it's boring, but this is a good reason not to go because I get bored to death. And I think, but at the same time, when I came out of that, I was sort of a lost human being.
Mm.
When you lose your faith, it's a weird place to be in.
Yeah.
You have to rebuild. I don't know. It's just scary and hard. And I think that's why a lot of people cling to whatever it is they were told when they were growing up.
Hmm. Maybe that's why I don't really have much experience with that sort of thing because my upbringing was never religious at all. And there was, in my household, there was some talk of God and apparently there was this guy named Jesus and, you know, we had a Bible in the house, but I think it was in the attic. So my parents pretty much just left it to me and my sister to figure these things out on our own. And I kind of asked the same question that you did. It was like, well, if we're right, then why are all these other religions wrong? And I didn't get a very good answer. I was like, That sounds rather fishy. And it wasn't, but I didn't have like a big deconversion. I'm kind of grasping for a term here. I'm not getting it. I didn't have a big deconversion crisis, I guess you would say. Right. So it was just kind of like nothing for me, except for occasional thoughts about like how, you know, how large is the universe, and you know, how far back does time go, and how could it be seemingly infinite, or you know, because I really wasn't thinking about like what science was saying about these things, so I didn't know what the Big Bang was. So it's kind of funny thinking that like a 9-year-old thinking about these things, but that's kind of where I was. But
right. Well, I mean, it sounds like actually the questions that you were asking were normal, I think, human questions that come out of, you know, a reasonable place of not knowing what the hell is going on, if that makes sense.
Right.
Because, I mean, your questions are questions that scientists struggle to theorize about and figure out. And I think that and those questions are unanswered and maybe unanswerable ultimately, by human beings anyway. I think that religion fills in those gaps. I mean, religion creates points where there are none, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, and I'm not an atheist. I'm kind of devoutly agnostic.
Yeah.
Because I think I mean, my argument for being agnostic is I think it's the most reasonable thing, because currently there is no evidence one way or the other about any of that stuff. And I certainly find the concept of spirituality really interesting and, you know, afterlife scenarios and all that. I think, you know, buying into anything as factual when I don't have intrinsic evidence of it, that doesn't work for me. But it's certainly, I like to think about it. I like to think about spirituality, and I'd certainly love for there to be hard evidence of whatever. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it's sort of an act of insanity to define it, but I see what you're saying about your childhood, but I'm not raising my kid religiously. I mean, we talk about religion and spirituality and all that stuff.
Right.
But we're not forcing any system of beliefs on him. So it'll be interesting to see if he kind of winds up asking questions in that way. And it'll be weird because, you know, when I asked similar questions as a kid, you know, the answers were there. You know, God, Jesus died for your sins, all this craziness. But it's a little different when I answer those questions with my kid, because I'm sort of like, I don't know. Here's what some people believe. Here's what some people believe. Here's what I like to believe. But it's kind of up to you.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know. It's, we'll see how that works out.
Yeah. I was kind of thinking about the way, just like when I was talking about my perspective about how, you know, some questions of spirituality just never, don't come up with me because, you know, it was just never part of my upbringing. But in the same sense, it took me a while to really get back to sympathizing with people of faith, because for a while I was one of those obnoxious people who was kind of very dissident about religion and would say a lot of obnoxious things. And after a while I was just like, you know, there are these guys like Pat Robertson who say the most horrible thing, but the most Christians are fine. They're benign. So why am I saying all these vile things about these nice people? So I stopped doing that, and I'm much happier. So,
yeah, I definitely find that an acceptance of other people versus a simple tolerance can lighten your mood. But at the same time, I mean, I'm always, as far as religion, organized religion is concerned, I'm always sort of at odds with it, because I totally agree with you. Most of the people, I mean, my mom still goes to church and all that, and I don't hold church going against people, and I fully believe in the freedom of religion, but so often it seems like organized religion does on some level get usurped by extremists and become a violence factory. And I think most large organized religions, even the small ones, have demonstrated those dark qualities. So then the question becomes, I read this book called The End of Faith. And I think the author's name was Sam Harris. But it was like he was very condemning of religion. Although not Buddhism. I don't know why.
I don't know.
Like he's like condemning most religions, but Buddhism's okay. And I don't necessarily agree with that standpoint, because I've seen lots of, you know, cults that are based on Buddhism that I think can be very destructive. Mm-hmm. They're obviously, you know, small things, but I've seen their effects on human beings, and I don't care for it. But one of the things he said, and I thought it was an interesting point, and I really don't know, again, I don't know how I feel about this, but it was an interesting point. And he was basically saying, well, as long as there is moderate religion, as long as there are faith-based communities and societies that work on faith-based things, then there will be violence. So in other words, there is no extremist religion without the moderate religion backing it up. Mm-hmm. Like if his point was that, you know, wars and that kind of violence would be greatly reduced if there was no faith-based religions, organized religions and societies that are built up around faith. And it's an interesting point. I mean, that's his theory, and there obviously is a lot of violence that comes out of religion. But again, you know, I know so many people, like I've gotten in, you know, debates, because I went through a phase like you did where I was just sort of anti-religion.
Right.
And I got over it too, and I'm a lot more mellow. But I mean, I'm constantly, like, I'm in LA, man, and this town is, there's so many magical thinkers here, and That just annoys me.
Right.
It annoys me. There's people in my life who I love and I think are great, and they're super intelligent and sweet and wonderful. But then, like, every now and then their magical thinking rears its ugly head, and I can't, you know, you can't have any negative opinion about anything with these people, because then they're like, you're manifesting some, you know, horror show in your life by feeling negativity towards something. And I'm like,
right.
Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the idea that you can positive think yourself into a fortune is ridiculous. And the idea that everybody who has a giant fortune did so by thinking positively. Come on.
Right.
There's plenty of rich, they're genuine rich assholes. There are nice rich people too, but there are rich assholes. They didn't get there by being nice and positive and manifesting good energies from the universe. They got rich by fucking people over, man. So I don't know. It's just that sort of, I guess it's like when people insist, like people who come to my door and they want to talk to me about Jesus and all that stuff. I'm like, I don't, for one, there's a sign out here that says no soliciting. I don't know why no one understands the definition of that word anymore, I guess.
Right.
But no, people always come to my door, and it doesn't matter what they're roofers, they're religious people, whatever. And they come to my door, or landscaping crews, whatever, real estate people. And they come to my door and it says no soliciting. And when I say, oh, did you see the sign? They go, yes, but I'm not soliciting. And then immediately follow that by soliciting me for something. Have people forgotten what that word means? My Adeline?
I'm wondering if they're getting it confused with loitering somehow. It's like, how do you make that mistake?
I don't know, but I find that agitating. If your system of beliefs works for you and it makes you happy, that's great, but I don't like it when people get in my face with it.
Right.
Then I get ornery and agitated, and maybe I should. Maybe I should be. I mean, I don't yell at people anymore. I'll yell at the people who come to my door because I'm in the middle of something and they're banging on the door and then want to talk to me about Jesus. But I'm, you know, more talking about like when friends do it, I don't get mad at anybody. I'll listen to them, but there's a part of me that gets annoyed.
See, I would be like, you just interrupted me watching internet porn to talk to me about Jesus, huh?
See what
the reaction is.
then they'll call me a sinner and they'll want to save me. I can only see that getting worse. I've thought about it though. I've thought about like, hey, why don't you guys come in? We'll have a three-way and you can tell me about Jesus while we do that. But I don't know. I don't have the heart, I guess.
I had a thought. I just lost it.
That happens to me all the time.
It was, the magical thinking. That's sort of what started me kind of mellowing. It's just that I found myself losing sleep more over people who are just con artists instead of just, you know, people who believe things that I don't believe. So that kind of turned me. And what also turned me was the work of someone named Robert M. Price, who I actually don't own any of his books, but I did listen to a podcast that he did long time ago where he would talk about religion. And what's interesting about this guy is that unlike Harris, he's not quite a scold. He's much more mellow about Christianity, and he doesn't believe in Christianity, but he still goes to church and he still loves the Bible. And he kind of got me on this path of thinking, well, you know, everyone kind of puts their own spin on religion. So it's even the extremists think that they have like such a hard case for what they have, and they're being as literal as they can, but no, even they kind of budge the lines here and there. So I'm like, well, all religion is arbitrary then. So I can't, you know, it's kind of an interesting way to look at it. And,
I think maybe kind of a more mellow way to look at it. I mean, I guess the way I look at it is that I mean, I think, you know, no matter what religion you're talking about or form of spirituality you're talking about, I think I always think there's something to it. That's why I'm saying I'm a devout agnostic, mm-hmm. because I don't think that human spirituality is non-existent, you know. I mean, it's like my mother-in-law is an atheist. So she's, you know, she's that, you know, when you're dead, you're dirt. That's it. You know, it's,
right.
That's it. But I think, you know, I don't know. There is a spirit to, I mean, and I've met human beings who don't seem to have a soul. You know what I mean? They're just cold and empty and there's nothing going on.
Right.
But there are a lot of people I've met that have, you know, a soulful presence, you know, what seems like a spirit, something maybe that's a little bit more than just, you know, our simple biological makeup. So, I mean, I think there's something to it. I guess like where I draw the line is I'm not going to live my life according to a bunch of things that were made up based on these feelings.
Right.
And I'm not saying that the feelings are illegitimate. They're probably very legitimate, but I think the definition of them is what is dangerous. And in a lot of ways kind of ruins spirituality itself. Because if you can't go out and constantly ask questions, and because if it is sort of in a more of an emotional state, a feeling than it is a literal fact, a literal human being who was descended from a god or whatever,
right.
Then you stop questioning it, and then your spirituality, if your spirituality isn't evolving, then it's, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like, I don't know, a very positive spirituality, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it, as much as, you know, science changes with thought and, I mean, science, that's what I like about science is science, you know, and when you mix in, you know, corporate science, then you get more like absolute sounding things, but real scientists, when new evidence arises, they change their entire system of belief.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think spirituality should exist in the same way. So I think the minute you assign a figurehead and rules and all this, then it becomes stagnant. And also, you know, it starts leading to violence, because if you believe in something that you can't prove to the degree that, you know, a devoutly religious person does, then that would cause friction with people who disagree. You know what I mean?
Right.
As opposed to if you're just two people who had one set of spiritual beliefs that were your own, and you have a conversation with someone who has a different set of spiritual beliefs, then maybe those spiritual beliefs will intermingle on some way, mm-hmm. and you'll walk away with a new system of spiritual beliefs that was better.
Right.
I mean, same, you know, same as science. When new evidence arises, they change their theories accordingly. And it's usually better and suddenly makes more sense.
Right. And where I was kind of going before, my brain went off on a tangent. I forgot what my point was earlier, but where I was going was that when you look at religion, particularly Christianity, about, you know, how there's really no, there's really no one way to look at it. Then what am I trying to say here? There's a lot of criticism of moderate Christianity about how, they just pick and choose. And that's where I was kind of going was, but all sides pick and choose. So, you know, if you look at, in the Bible where Sam Harris brought up about how there's all these violent things in the Bible and it's justifying this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, if you take a perspective that is like, that says, well, you know, all sides pick and choose. I am not explaining this very well at all, but it's kind of a justification and my way of accepting that, you know, people have their own way of thinking and no one way is necessarily right. And even within Christianity, which I don't think is I have no connection to Christianity whatsoever, but even within that frame set, I used to be kind of like a scold on moderates, but then I kind of stopped because I'm like, well, they're not really doing anything that's different from what the extremists are doing, except that they're just nice people. And I don't know. There was a point that I had here. And
well, I mean, what you're saying there is sort of, well, I don't know. I mean, that's sort of what Sam Harris was saying.
Yeah.
You know, in that, there's nothing wrong with moderately religious people accepting that they believe in this system that the moderates give it weight, and then the extremists obviously take it to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
But his sort of argument is if there wasn't such a large base of moderates, then the extremists would just seem crazy. I don't know. Religion's wonky.
Yeah.
The more I talk about religion, the more I get confused.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what was happening to me. I guess it's just that Robert M. Price is such a mellow guy, and he looks at religion from an outside perspective and has his own spin, and that's I kind of like his way of approaching it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would like to read some of his stuff.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I definitely think, I don't know, I think there's something to, I mean, I guess some people get old and they get more tense and angry, about the world. But I definitely feel like as I'm getting older, I'm mellowing out way more. And I mean, it's like, you know, it's not just religion too. I used to get pissed about movies, like fly off the handle. About friggin' movies, and then right. You know, you get older and wiser, and you're like, why the hell did I get so mad about that? I mean, it's okay to not like a movie, but geez, why? Why did Titanic make me so angry? I don't know. I mean, I still don't like it, but it doesn't. I would never yell at somebody for liking it anymore. But I think that's just a youthful sort of angry young man thing. And the older you get, if you're smarter, then you do get mellow. You stop being angry at people just because they're silly, I guess.
Yeah. I wonder if we should kind of like trail off in like a movie discussion here because you brought up Titanic and movies.
Okay, sure. What are your movie questions?
Well, I don't really have a set of questions here, but I was just wondering, what would you consider like a bad movie? Like, do you have any like, I guess you'd say qualifiers for what a bad movie is? Like, do you look?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of bad movies. I mean, and really, if you look at the vast majority of movies and creative works in general, most of it's not very good.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's just, but, you know, it's, that seems true about everybody's subjective opinion. Although I know like my in-laws drive me nuts because no matter what movie they go see, they like it. You know why? Because they simply like going to the movies. And it's actually a cool, I mean, it drives me nuts because they'll say, oh, that movie's really good. You should see it. And I'll see it and go, this is terrible. Why did they tell me to see this? And I forget that they just like going to the movies. So if they're in a movie theater, I mean, it has to be egregiously awful for them to walk away angry. Cause they're just happy. The experience of going to the movies, the ritualistic experience is what they love. So a movie has to be really unbelievably offensive on some level for them to get mad about it.
Right.
I remain more critical than that. It doesn't piss me off. I mean, if I had seen A Good Day to Die Hard when I was, 26, 27, I would probably have burned the theater down, but I saw it as a 41-year-old man. And even though, you know, the first Die Hard remains one of my favorite movies and, you know, as silly as the, you know, first couple sequels were, they were at least, you know, had some amusing factor. And even, and the fourth one, you know, was only a letdown really because it was PG-13, but it wasn't a horrible, dumb action movie. It was fine. I mean, this just new one was just really unbelievably bad. It was not, I can't say it was disappointing. It was almost expected. If I had had that cinema going experience when I was 27, I would have thrown into some kind of rage. I would have lit into a rage. But as a 41-year-old man, I was like, it's sad, but whatever. It's just a goddamn movie, you guys.
See, for me, it's, what it usually comes down to is the length of the movie. It's like, I accept that most movies are pretty bad, but I'll sit through almost anything. But once it goes over that 2-hour mark, I start getting antsy. Actually, before that, when I hit the 100-minute mark, I start getting antsy.
I'm the same way. Although, you know, just to, I don't know if you saw A Good Day to Die Hard.
No.
But just to drive home how bad it was, that movie is 90 minutes long. And like Die Hard with a Vengeance is like 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
And as dumb as Die Hard with a Vengeance is, it's immensely more ludicrously entertaining than this 90-minute new Die Hard, which is, I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, and it's weird and it is subjective because I'm sure there are people out there who were somehow entertained by A Good Day to Die Hard. But, for me, the worst kind of movie is the movie that is ultimately dull and doesn't completely distract me from the world, you know? I will watch a really bad movie like Chud and enjoy the hell out of it because it's entertaining despite itself. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that's what a good bad movie is it's just so dumb, it's fun, and you're amused the whole time. I think the movies that I don't like are the movies that are intensely, dull. And I think that once you go past 100 minutes, then chances are you've put too much into your movie and I'm going to start losing interest even if I liked it. Like I just finally saw The King's Speech because I have a phobia about Academy Award nominated movies. Cause they're usually, you know, disappoint me on some level. And I thought The King's Speech was a good movie and certainly well acted and touching and stuff, but there was, you know, a 15-20 minute lull in there that I was like, I don't know why they couldn't lop this out. They would have had a really nice 90 minute movie. And it was just, it was too much and it was repetitive. There were only so many scenes. I got that the king and the weird speech therapist, were becoming really good friends despite themselves. But I didn't need more of that. And there was a lot of that in that movie. You know what I mean?
Right. It's like Peter Jackson syndrome. People don't know how to use scissors anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I hear Peter Jackson's name referenced about that all the time, but it just seems like, I mean, and he obviously has made these ludicrously long movies, including the last one with the Hobbit movie, right. Where there's like a 20 minute sequence where they're doing dishes.
Oh boy. I haven't seen this movie yet.
Oh yeah. The first act of the film is mostly these trolls or whatever they are, dwarves that come by Bilbo's house and they do dishes and they sing and they do dishes and they eat. And I'm like, well, are we going to get to the movie or are we just going to watch these assholes do dishes? I mean, it was unbelievable. So yeah, there's definitely an editing problem, in Hollywood now. I totally agree with you. I'm 100% on board. I think the ideal running time of a movie is 90 minutes and everything after 90 minutes. I mean, cause I think there is such a thing, obviously, as a completely engaging 3-hour movie. But I think those are incredibly rare. Mm-hmm. And I think that once you, I think good filmmakers, once they get to the 90 minute mark, if they can't get it down to the 90 minute mark, then that means that their 2 hours or whatever it is actually is all completely relevant to the story and entertaining. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, who's the novelist who said, cut out all the stuff that people will skip over, you know?
Yeah.
You said that was the secret to writing a good novel is just cut all the crap that people are going to skip over anyway. And it's a little easier to skip over a few paragraphs when you're reading a book than it is to know when to stop fast forwarding through. Well, in The Hobbit, I can tell you, it's just as soon as they stop doing dishes, you can start watching the movie again.
The absurdity of The Hobbit is just that, here's a book, you know, the Lord of the Rings, each of the three books are actually two sub-books put together. So it's actually 6 books. But the Hobbit is actually a single book that's shorter than one of those 6 books. And yet they're making a 3-movie epic that is as long as the previous trilogy. I don't know how they're doing that.
Well, this is how they're doing it. They're having extended scenes of dwarves doing dishes. The third movie is just going to be nothing but dwarves doing dishes.
Oh God.
Cause they're going to get to, yeah. I mean, and The Hobbit also, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and I'm no fan of the books either, really. I find them really slow. But The Hobbit is really that's more of a kid's novel.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a young reader's novel. Whereas Lord of the Rings was more a young adults series. So The Hobbit is also, you know, a way simpler story than the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So yeah, they took a children's book and they're stretching it into this epic trilogy, but that's why it just, I mean, the first one just, I don't know, it just didn't work.
I think I might just stick with the Rankin Bass version.
Oh God. Yeah. My kid loves that. I can't stand it, man.
It is an acquired taste. I can see that.
Well, my wife likes it too, but she grew up on it, you know, all of those, the Hobbit one and the Lord of the Rings one.
And
then there was a Return of the King one too, right?
Yeah.
mean, the Rankin Bass did the whole trilogy, but she grew up mostly on the Hobbit one.
Right.
But, so she has nostalgia for it, but I didn't grow up on it, and I find it, rough going for me. Rough going.
And I suppose the last question I have in this rambly, unprepared, and and very digression-filled podcast is these long movies. Do you think anyone is actually going to be watching these in years to come? Because that's what I'm constantly wondering this, because, you know, a 90-minute movie, you know, I can watch that without really planning ahead. If I catch something on cable, I'll be like, oh, I'll watch this. But a 3-hour movie, it feels like I have to plan my evening around it. It's like, who has time to do that? Is anyone going to be watching Transformers Dark of the Moon in 10 years?
No. No, they won't. I mean, maybe in 10 years, but I mean, and those will be, I suppose there will be nostalgic viewers of the Transformers. But I mean, it's not gonna, stand a genuine test of time, because they're just giant CGI spectacles, and the effects that made them visually impressive to the audiences that watched them when they came out, it's not going to be visually impressive in 10 or 15 years. And the stories of any of them are not compelling enough for people to forgive special effects. I mean, I think that, you know, something like Jaws, winds up, you know, getting handed down generation to generation, because, you know, it's an actual story with actual characters. You know what I mean? It's right. Not Megan Fox bending over a motorcycle and Shia LaBeouf being silly, and then CGI tourney gadgets that are shiny. I think it's story ultimately that is going to stand the test of time. If it's a good story, then people are way more forgiving of special effects. And special effects are so, what's the word I'm looking for? Finite. They're of a time. I mean, you even go back and you watch, like now, you go back and you watch effects driven movies from the 90s, and they don't look that good.
No.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, and for me, on a certain level, it's fun to go back and watch, you know, disaster movies from the 90s, but you even compare those to the bad disaster movies from now. It's like the effects are not, they don't hold up. And because the stories, you know, as funny as Volcano starring Tommy Lee Jones is, I mean, that movie is so dumb, but that story is not going to stand the test of time, and it can't rise above its effects. But, you know, a movie like Jaws, I think, can. I mean, and, you know, Star Wars 2, I mean, I think, you know, versus this, you know, the original Star Wars versus the prequels, is more likely to stand the test of time, because it's easier to forgive those effects because the characters are fun and the story is relatable. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I show those to my 7-year-old, and he's seen way more sophisticated effects, but he's still enjoys Star Wars and can forgive those effects. If I show him like another movie from the 80s, like, I don't know, like The Last Starfighter or something like that, then he gets bored and the effects look stupid to him. And, you know, he doesn't have that problem so much watching Star Wars because it's more engaging.
Right.
And I know a lot of people who, you know, didn't see Star Wars until they were adults, and they don't think that much of it. And I get that, because it really is a movie for kids. But I think it's a good movie for kids. It's a good adventure movie for kids. So, and we adults who still watch it are, certainly nostalgic, for that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I really think the reason why it translates from generation to generation is it does have, however simple, a very relatable story, you know, about basically about a kid growing up and fun characters, you know, the Han Solo and the Princess Leia, and you know, all of them are fun. So you don't get bugged by older effects if you're having fun with some characters. But I don't see that happening with Shia LaBeouf in Transformers. I don't think that. What was his name? Witwicky?
Sam Witwicky. Yeah.
Sam Witwicky. Yeah. I don't think. I can't believe I remembered the name. But I don't. I just don't see that character standing the test of time. And those movies, honestly, and I've seen all of them at this point, and none of them made any sense.
The only thing I remember from those movies is a lot of shaky cam and Megan Fox on the motorcycle. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's fair. Those are really the highlights. Shaky camera and her bent over motorcycles. That's why you see those movies.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you for appearing on the Toncast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Is there any other podcast or website that you're a part of that you'd like to plug?
You should watch the Film Pigs web series on geeknation.com. And they're now putting up old episodes of the show on YouTube. So watch that. And you can listen to the Film Pigs podcast. And also I just started another movie centric podcast called Jason and Todd Talk Through Lousy Films. And it's this, buddy of mine who's a Los Angeles critic, and we sit down and just yammer while movies play. It's not really an alternative commentary. It's really just two assholes talking while a movie's playing.
Which is fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Why not? Everybody else is doing it.
All right, and you can check out my other podcast, which is Animation Aficionados at animationaficionados.com. I also do a webcomic, dasien.com, dasien.com. It's not updating this week, but will be again shortly. And I'd like to thank Todd Robert Anderson for being on the show, and thank you for listening. Good night, everyone.
Good night.